More and more people in the U.S. are reporting being diagnosed with depression. Recent polling from Gallup found that nearly 3 out of 10 people say they have been told by a doctor or nurse that they have depression at some point in their lives. That number has risen steadily from 2015, when the rate was only 2 out of 10. And the percentage of people who report currently having a depression diagnosis is up about 7% over that same time span. The CDC released a new report earlier this month that confirmed similar nationwide numbers as of 2020, and that CDC data showed Wisconsin ranked 23rd in the nation in rates of depression, right around 20%. We're exploring some of the possible causes and solutions to depression, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think might be causing this increase in the rate of diagnosis of depression? Are there solutions you think could start reverse this trend? If you've experienced depression yourself or in your family and are willing to share your story, love to hear from you. Was there a treatment that you found that worked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jack Nitschke is a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, happy to be here.
Can you give us sort of the basic definition of depression from a clinical standpoint?
Yeah, so depression can occur in a number of different forms. The most common form is something that we technically talk about as major depressive disorder. And it is essentially a set of 9 different symptoms, one of which is depressed mood. Another of the common ones is not the inability to experience pleasure or not having interest in things that we usually are interested in. And then there's a set of other symptoms that include different things, including disturbances to sleep, either insomnia or sleeping too much, called hypersomnia, disturbances with eating, having no appetite at all, or some people are depressed are suddenly eating a whole lot, as well as just symptoms like fatigue and feeling worthless, having trouble making up one's mind about something. So as you can see, depression involves a number of different symptoms here, and any individual might have some subset of those, but typically how we go about defining depression is that you have to have 5 out of these 9 symptoms.
Looking at these numbers with higher rates of depression diagnosis, that sounds bad. Certainly a lot of us are depressed and that's bad news, but it could also be that maybe we're paying more attention, we're seeking out treatment, we're doing a better job of screening for it. Do you have a sense of what might be driving that numbers? More depression, or we're more alert to depression?
So there are many factors that contribute to the cause of depression. And the question here with these latest data that have just come out is, what is leading to this increase currently? I don't think there's been a real stark increase in recent, just in the last couple of years, in terms of just the increased awareness of it. Now, that may have been happened a little bit with the pandemic. It certainly happened a lot over the last 30 years. For a long period of time, we were not seeing increased numbers in depression, but we also weren't seeing decreased numbers in depression, despite the fact that we have now much better treatments for it. So this has been, an issue for us in the field of wanting to, have rates of depression decrease from what they are. So, but your question as to why are they increasing now, again, there could be several factors. I think one of the things we have to look at is the pandemic, which, thankfully we're on the backside of. But, during the pandemic, that certainly isolated folks. We know that social support is really good at helping keep depression at bay. But also the pandemic interrupted people's work and led to inflation by interrupting the supply chain. This led to financial stress. We know that financial stress is going to feed anxiety and depression. And so that too could in part be leading to higher rates of depression.
And you mentioned treatments for depression, and I want to definitely talk about that. What are the main kinds of treatment out there that seem to be proving effective, at least for some people experiencing depression?
Yeah, there's 2 basic classes of treatment that are kind of the front line of treatment. One is in the field of psychotherapy, and we have different treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapy, another type of treatment known as interpersonal therapy for depression. Another treatment, that's called ACT. And so there's a number of treatments that have been developed over the years that are very good and empirically are we have evidence that really do help people get over their depressive episodes. On the flip side, for those who don't want to do some of the work that's involved with psychotherapy, there's also the possibility of taking medications. We have antidepressants that are very good for treating depression in a lot of individuals. And these are some, really some household names now, such as Prozac and Zoloft, as well as a host of others that have very similar chemical properties to those two. And that target specific neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And those two have been found to be helpful with depression.
We're talking about depression, rising rates of depression diagnosis here in the United States, and treatments with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Jack, a lot of your research, I know, involves the idea of neuroplasticity. And this is a key part of understanding how some of those treatments you talked about work. First of all, what do we mean by neuroplasticity?
So neuroplasticity is a set of brain mechanisms that are involved in helping us adapt to change and leading us to be able to do things such as learn. And so basically the idea here is that whatever it is that you're going to spend your time doing, particularly those things that you repeat over and over again, you will build neural connections that support that behavior or that thought or that feeling. And such that, if, for example, in depression, something that's common is that you have self-critical thoughts. And if you think I'm no good, and we have maybe somebody that's told us we're not good enough when we're young children, and then we practice, and then we kind of hear that multiple times, and then we actually internalize that and walk around such that we're saying, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. Each time that gets that repetition, it is strengthening those neural circuits that support that in our brain. And so then part of what we're doing with psychotherapy is actually going in and testing, is that true? Am I really not good at something? And for all of my patients, I find the good aspects of who they are. We talk about that and the evidence for that. And then what we're doing is slowly building neural connections that support the knowledge that they are indeed good people as they walk through their life.
And that plasticity idea, I could see somebody, especially in the midst of depression, saying all those things are carved in stone, the bad self-talk and things like that. But we can, if I'm hearing you right, Jack, have a new process of learning that gets a new set of connections, literally neural connections in our brain that provides an alternative?
Yeah, it's exactly right. We've talked about a little bit the bad news about neuroplasticity here. The bad news about neuroplasticity, if we do have these self-critical thoughts, is once that's been practiced along a lot, that's around essentially for the rest of our lives. Things that we have done a lot of repetition for, we are going to have neural connections that support that for the rest of our life. We can't go in and surgically remove that. So that's kind of the bad news. The good news, however, is that we can go and use those exact same neuroplasticity mechanisms to learn new truths about who we are and how we are able to handle situations. And then we can practice those, repeat that, such that we are building new neural circuits that more accurately reflect who we are, and that can help us to feel better.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hello, sir.
What did you want to share with us, Mike?
I felt like my dad and I connected better altogether, and he's passed away, but my mom and I never saw things the same way. I'm just wondering, I got divorced 3 years ago, and I need some help.
Mike, I'm so sorry to hear all of that, and best to you. Now, Jack, obviously I won't ask you to diagnose and prescribe options for Mike, but for somebody in that position, very dark position in his life right now, what can people do to start seeking help?
Yeah, so what Mike is referring to or is indicating that he's struggling with is grief. And grief is a very close relative of depression, and it's associated with sadness. There's also other elements that can be present, other components of grief, including there can be feelings of anger there. There can be feeling times where one's in denial about having lost somebody, as well as there are periods of time maybe that Mike has where he is very much accepting that his father is not here, yet still has a great deal of sadness. We know with grief that grief is actually something that stays with us when you have somebody as close to us as it sounds like Mike was with his father, that grief will probably stay with Mike for much of his life, but it will take on different forms, such that when Mike is, you know, if is able to process some of this grief, talk through both the wonderful things about his dad and the connection that they had, as well as just acknowledging, you know, the sadness not only of losing his father, but also the end of that marriage. And to process that and work with that. And essentially, he's going to be to speak with speak to what I just spoke about with the neural connections. He's going to be building up some neural connections for how do you kind of walk through life without dad physically present here.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Best to you as you deal with all of that. And Jack, I wonder about, in addition to maybe one-on-one therapy, what do you think about support groups? Because obviously the people Mike would want to talk to things about in tough times, well, that's not an option now. Are there things like grief support groups or divorce support groups that people can at least get some of that from?
Absolutely. There are good grief support groups out there that will tell you a little bit about the different stages or components of grief, as well as just to have you be in a setting where you can be with other people who are also really struggling with the loss of somebody that they have loved very dearly, as it's really clear is the case for Mike.
We're talking to clinical psychologist and UW-Madison professor Jack Nitschke about depression and an increasing rate of patients receiving a diagnosis of depression over the last handful of years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we could start to reduce rates of depression in our society, big picture and individually too? What questions do you have about the way we diagnose and treat depression? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, looking at a growing number of people diagnosed with depression in the United States, what treatment and possible solutions are out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take to improve mental health in our country? Do you have a question for our guest about diagnosis, treatment, the causes of depression? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hey, here's another number. If you need it or a loved one needs it, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, that's a call or a text to 988. Again, that's 988. Jack, I want to talk a little more about the causes of depression. Sometimes we think of it as, you know, a traumatic maybe life event causing it. Sometimes we hear, at least in the past I've heard about, you know, this is a brain chemistry thing. Are they both out there? Is it some of each? What do we think about the causes now?
Yeah, there are many factors that are causal in nature, and one of the issues that I like to be really careful about being a neuroscientist myself is to move away from some thinking about, oh, this is just, you know, something that happens in the brain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the brain is going to be involved in it. This is, you know, the organ that helps us have feelings and emotions. It mediates that process. But it's also really, really key that there are other components that contribute to that as well. And these components are things that are happening in our environment. They may be some things from childhood. They could be trauma that can lead to profound feelings of depression and trauma of all different sorts. And they can also be things that happen to us later in life, difficulties with with employment or losing a friend. And then importantly, as we just heard about, is, you know, the end of a marriage potentially can be a cause for depression, as well as sometimes losing somebody goes beyond just the grief, but can be a more protracted period of depression that some people experience after losing a loved one. So exact nature of what the cause of depression is really multifactorial.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Sauk City. Jackie, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jackie?
I just wanted to say I'm a community psychiatric nurse, and so I was listening to the program and was very interested in what Mike had to say. And I just feel like your speaker didn't necessarily point him into a direction that could be helpful, and I would encourage Mike to seek help from his primary care doctor, who could possibly assess him for suicidality, and then get him started on an antidepressant if the doctor felt that was necessary, and then refer him to outpatient psychiatric treatment somewhere.
Jackie, thanks for that call. And Jack, I've heard and I've talked to guests about making sure that more primary care physicians are doing these kind of screenings for depression and other mental health needs, making the kind of referrals Jackie is talking about. Do you feel like we're getting better at doing those things?
I don't know what Jackie thinks about it. I think we are getting better at doing those. And Jackie's certainly right on spot on in terms of the recommendations she's making there. Our primary care physicians are oftentimes very good at helping to manage. And indeed, a number of people will just be on an antidepressant medication that their primary care physician is managing. So, and then a lot of times, as Jackie just alluded to, it can be very helpful for the primary care physician to say, oh, this is looking a little bit more complex, might be a benefit to have some psychotherapy, and if the depression gets really bad over a period of time, there's also other forms of treatment that can be utilized that have been shown to be helpful, and to make that referral to mental health, behavioral health services.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jack, do we have enough services available for people who are seeking help, who do need help, or is it hit or miss depending on where we are?
In terms of psychiatric services, I would say we do not have enough. I'm part of a big department here in Madison, so associated with the University of Wisconsin, our Department of Psychiatry, and it has been something that we have really worked very hard to meet and provide access to all the people in the community who are asking for services. It's become even a greater need since the pandemic. We've increased the numbers of our providers multiple fold, and we still are not able to meet all the need in the community. This is a place where indeed, though, primary care physicians do help out. So when somebody has a form of depression that is more manageable, that can be overseen by a primary care physician doc. And that is happening, increasingly.
I want to get back to the idea of neuroplasticity. Another thing you work on is human brain imaging. I mean, are we at a point where we could image our brain and see ourselves making these connections to counter the paths we've built up in the past when it comes to things like depression?
No, we're not at that point, and I don't know that we will necessarily get to that point with brain imaging. The brain imaging is not at nearly as molecular of a level as that, so it's looking at more different areas of the brain, how different areas are involved when it's done with depression and anxiety, how different areas of the brain are involved differentially on different types of tasks. One thing that's become really clear from the last 30 years of the huge amount of brain imaging work that's now been done is that there is no center in the brain that is the source of depression here, and that it's a much more complicated picture than that. And I think one of some of this work that's been done with neuroplasticity and an understanding that can really help understand what is going on in a person's brain as this depression is developing, as well as when they're getting effective treatment.
And we've been focusing on individual diagnosis and treatment a lot here, Jack. Getting back to, this overall increase in depression, you mentioned earlier, isolation from COVID, disruption from COVID might have been a cause of that increase. Does that point us towards some society-wide solutions? Are there things we could do as a country that might build those connections, do things that help prevent people being depressed in the first place?
Yeah, I think there certainly are with some of that. I mean, so one is just policies that we are going to have. So I think, in terms of, having, making sure that employment and income is being supported so that people can, meet the cost of living, making sure that we're keeping an eye on inflation and keeping the cost of living down that way. So I think there's policy work that can be done there. And then I think there's things we can do in the community really to encourage the social support that people can have access to, encourage kind of community involvement so that people can turn to people when they are feeling, when they are struggling. One of the things that you've mentioned here is the 988 number. That's just a crisis line. It's also a suicide hotline. That's, another good tool that's just come online, the 988 specifically. There was a much longer 800 number that was used for many years prior to that. But this 988 number just allows for more accessibility for people to get the help and the support they need.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about why we're seeing more and more of it in the U.S., what we can do about it. And again, that number 988 for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You can call or text 988.